This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. This week, the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame announced its latest round of inductees. And among them is singer-songwriter Randy Newman. You have to have 25 years as an artist to qualify for the Hall of Fame. But Newman has clocked a lot more time than that. His first album, Randy Newman, was released in 1968, 44 years ago. After writing such songs as Sail Away and Short People, he shifted his focus to Hollywood, where he's enjoyed a prolific and successful career writing scores for live-action and animated films, from Ragtime to Toy Story. He won an Oscar for Best Original Song, which he wrote for Monsters, Inc. Most recently, he's been revisiting his catalog in a series of American Songbook solo albums, just Newman and his piano. Here's his new recording of one of his sharpest satirical songs, Political Science. Newman wrote it in 1972, yet 40 years later, it's anything but dated.
No one likes us. I don't know why. We may not be perfect, but heaven knows we try. But all around, even our old friends put us down. Let's drop the big one and see what happens. We give them money, but are they grateful? No, they're spiteful and they're hateful. They don't respect us, so let's surprise them. We'll drop the big one and pulverize it. Asia's crowded and Europe's too old. Africa's far too hot and Canada's too cold. And South America stole our name. Let's drop the big one. There'll be no one left to blame us. We'll save Australia.
That's Randy Newman performing Political Science from his American Songbook album, Volume 1. Today we'll hear two of Randy Newman's appearances on Fresh Air, beginning with an interview Terry did with him in 1992 when he was seated at a piano in our studio.
Have you developed a separate sound for accompanying yourself at the piano than you'd use if you were just sitting at the piano alone to play? I mean, do you think of yourself as having a sound that you use when you're singing?
A pianistic sound?
Yeah. I mean, I think of you as having one, but I couldn't explain it.
I don't think of it, but I probably just adjust to what I'm doing, yeah. I have a style of playing, I think, that I can tell it's me, if only because I can't keep time.
Is there a certain kind of left hand that you think of as you or something?
Oh, you know, my son does this imitation of me, you know, without hitting. He goes, I'm very fond of shuffles. I have been all my life. It seems to be my natural mode of expression. My mother was from New Orleans. I don't know whether that has anything to do with it, but you know. Blue Monday, I hate Blue Monday. Got to work like a slave all day. I mean, that's the stuff I love. And people don't tend to like shuffles that much, you know, and drummers hate them. But I've written more than I should have, you know, so maybe there's something to my left hand.
So when you first got access to a piano, when you were trying to do things that you heard?
As a kid?
Yeah, as a kid.
I never tried to do things I heard. I just played out of the little,
you know, the Thompson from a Wigwam book at the party. That was getting complicated there. But I never, there was music in my family. And I remember when I was about six, all of a sudden, there was like a piano in my room, you know, just in case I was Mozart, I think they wanted to have this thing looming, an upright, Hoffman upright, looming over me. My dad was a doctor, but he loved show business, you know. Before he went in the army, he went on that Hollywood Caravan tour. One of my uncles conducted that thing during the war, and he was a doctor on that, and I guess he never got over it. But I mean, I think he wanted me to be a musician, though he never admitted it. I mean, what was the piano doing there, you know?
Right.
I didn't know what to do with it.
So if you started off playing all these, you know, piano for beginner type
sure.
books, how did you start to learn rock and roll? Did you just pick it up from records? Could you?
I think I did when I was, started 15, 16. A friend of mine suggested, you know, why don't you try and write some songs? His father was in the record business, so I did. And then a publisher signed me up. But it isn't like... You'll hear stories. A lot of guys listen to a record. It did something to them. It clicked some kind of switch in them where they'd listen and copy the riffs on everything. I never did it. I was pushed kicking and screaming the whole way, it seems like, into music in some kind of ways. Even when I was in college and people would be all, they'd say, oh, did you hear Shostakovich's 11th Symphony? Or I don't know what it was then, about 11 maybe. I hadn't heard, but I was better than everybody at composition classes and stuff like that. Worse at, you know, sight singing and things like that. But I was good at it. I had talent for it.
What was the first kind of stuff you started writing at the piano for yourself?
The first thing I wrote was like a summer song. I was 16, 17. Man, they tell me it's summer. But I know it's a lie. Summer's for laughing. All I do is cry. Things like that, you know. Not really bad, but just vapid.
Can I ask you to do a chorus of Lonely at the Top?
Sure.
I just think that's one of your really kind of fun songs.
I've been around the world. Had my pick of any girl. You'd think I'd be happy, but I'm not. Everybody knows my name, but it's just a crazy game. Oh, it's lonely at the top. You know what I was noticing since you're sitting right here and I'm singing?
Yeah.
How hard it must have been, unless you're an actor in movies, you know, I was trying to look at you and sing. It's murder. It would be murder to listen, too, you know. I love you, I'll always love you. Jesus Christ.
It's really embarrassing to
I couldn't
to
do
be,
it.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you don't know what to do. I don't know what to
exactly,
do.
Exactly. So are you averting your eyes?
Oh, very much so. I'm afraid. As a matter of fact, I'm glad I can't see audiences. You know, when you do TV, they're lit up. So, you know, you're playing along on Letterman or Saturday Night Live, and you can see the people, and, you know, you see people talking to each other. I'm afraid to look.
Now, I remember from the last interview we did that you wrote that for Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, I did. And I thought it really would have been kind of hip if he did that.
Yeah.
And I played it for Streisand, but she said, well, people would believe it. You know, if she sung that, maybe she's right.
Do people believe it about you? Do they think that you're singing?
It depends. Some towns. You know, I used to play in Philadelphia, strangely enough, where we are, and they wouldn't laugh. They'd think I was at the time, even if there are 12 people in the audience, you know, at a club.
Randy Newman at the piano, recorded in 1992. We'll hear another interview Terry recorded with him after a break. This is Fresh Air. Randy Newman will be inducted next April into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, an honor that many say is long overdue. After all, he released his career-encompassing CD compilation, Guilty, 30 Years of Randy Newman, 14 years ago. Terry Gross spoke with him in 1999 about that CD compilation.
What was your image of a songwriter back then? This is a kind of transitional period in the early 60s. You know, you're past Tin Pan Alley. You're kind of in the end of the Lieber and Stoller era. And right at the kind of dawn of the period where bands were going to be writing their own songs.
The image I had was that ancient motion picture image of Tin Pan Alley and two guys hammering it out. And it was also of Carole King and Jerry Goffin and Barry Mann and Cynthia Weil and the people who were very successful contemporaneously with my attempts to write songs for people.
I want to get to another track from the third CD on your 4-CD box set, and this is the CD of demos and other mostly previously unreleased material. This is a song called Love is Blind, which is, you know, just as the first song that we heard, Golden Gridiron Boy, is very out of character for you, this kind of cheerful, well, not cheerful, no, but,
this isn't cheerful, but
an upbeat football song.
It's a generic lyric.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
That's what it is.
Right. You say in the notes that you wrote it when you were 18.
Yeah.
So you were 18 and already writing that love is bitter, love is hopeless, love is blind. It leads me to think that you already had a sense of your self as writing more dark and cynical songs than your average songwriter.
Well, there are some pretty lugubrious love songs, you know. I mean, a lot of them are pretty bleak, you know. He stopped loving her today and a lot of country things. But I was a pretty down cat, I guess. I don't know.
Well, let's hear the song Love is Blind, written in about 1962. The recording we'll hear is 1968. And this is from Randy Newman's box set, Guilty, 30 Years of Randy Newman.
They say that love's a sweet thing, and for lovers the sun will always shine. But in spite of what they say, I think of love this way. Love is bitter, love is hopeless, love is blind. I learned the hard and lonely way. Love can't last through the year. I spent 1,000 empty yesterday, hiding behind a veil of tears. Now poets may write about love, and wise men may sing his praise, but I'll always remember as I go through the empty day. Love is bitter, love is hopeless, love is blind.
Love is Blind, one of the demos on Randy Newman's box set, Guilty. What were you saying there?
I was laughing at the ending. You know, I was just sort of aimless wandering. You know, in the motion picture movie business, we call it grazing. You know, it's just like, you know, I was waiting to end it. I know where I should have gone, but I didn't go there. It made me laugh.
Well, that was a demo. Did you ever record it other than that for yourself?
No, I never thought enough of it.
Well, I like it a lot. Why don't you?
Yeah,
like
I do
it?
Too.
Okay.
Oh, Veil of Tears.
Well,
know, things
sure.
Like that. I mean, I grew to not be able to stand that stuff coming from myself. I mean, I'll listen to records and love them, and they'll have lyrics like that in them, but I can't do it. You know, it's like if you know better, don't do it.
I just figured I could put kind of like little quotes around the Veil of Tears and say, oh, that's a little tip of the hat to the genre.
Well, that's being too kind. I mean, it's just, you know, none of it was heartfelt in that, you know, I don't think I'd been in love with anybody. You know, I certainly didn't have all these sophisticated, you know, it's bitter and blind at 18, you know.
Uh-huh.
So, I mean, I hope not. I just didn't think of recording. I like it too. I like every word goes. The harmonic, you know, structure of it. I mean, it sounds like me. It's what I do today.
We're listening back to Terry's 1999 interview with Randy Newman. During the interview, she also asked him about his song, Maybe I'm Doing It Wrong, a waltz about sex not living up to expectations.
So many pop songs are supposed to be sung in the voice of the seducer who's bragging about how good a lover he is.
Yeah.
Did you intend this to subvert that kind of song?
Yeah. And it's really a great idea because it's a widespread thing. You know, people don't necessarily talk about it. I mean, you have no idea from knowing a person, my experiences at least, that what they're like sexually or you can't even guess at that. That and money. You know, you can try and borrow $5 from someone you've known for 30 years and they won't give it to you. And it's a complete unknown. And I really liked, this song is short, but I always thought it was a great idea for a song. And you know, I wished I'd done more, but I couldn't think of what more to do.
Well, let's hear it. This is Maybe I'm Doing It Wrong.
Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Just don't move me the way that it should. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. There ain't no book you can read. There ain't nobody to tell you. But I don't think I'm getting what everyone's getting. Maybe I'm doing it wrong. Sometimes I throw off a good one. At least I think it is. No, I know it is. I shouldn't be thinking at all. I shouldn't.
Why did you write that song as a waltz?
Don't know. It just came out that way. Almost every song I've written has had words and music sort of come at the same time. No, usually the music comes a little first. So I probably was just clumping along like that. And maybe I didn't do it for any artistic reason, though I'd be happy to take credit for any sort of Viennese reason that you'd like to give me.
Oh, well, thanks for the invitation. I have a reason I'd like to give you.
Yeah.
the song is about a kind of frustration in sexuality, but the waltz has such a nice lilt, such an easy lilt, that it's a nice contrast.
It does. You know, it bum, bum. Yeah, it's sort of in one. It could be... it might be also, I loved a record called If You Got to Make a Fool of Somebody. I don't know which came first, but I mean, I wanted to write something like that. This is an instance, I hear, listen to the audience, where sometimes, Harry Nilsson once told me, I asked him, you know, it was a constant thing with him not performing, why he didn't perform. And one time, it was mainly, I think, because he was frightened of it, I think, but I don't know. But he said once it was because he's worried it would hurt his work, that the audience reaction would be like throw him off because he wouldn't know his good stuff. And it's a very small thing, that thing. You can isolate it as a writer. I mean, the audience will react to some things. Like sometimes I'll throw off a good one. Like I probably could have done better there, you know? But they laughed at it. I knew they liked it. So I left it alone.
Randy Newman, thank you very much for talking with us.
Great pleasure, as always.
Randy Newman speaking to Terry Gross in 1999. He'll be inducted in April into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.